Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
So this is Pauly Shore. I'm here in, is it Bushwick?
It's Bushwick.
Bushwick, and we're here at Roberto's. And Roberta's, and we're at, on Heritage Radio. We're talking about food. We're talking about, big glasses, and we're talking about all the man buns. And you're listening to The Morning After.
Episode 183 of The Morning After. I'm your host, Sari Kamen. And my God, Pauly Shore makes me so happy. Oh, that was great. I am here in studio with my guest today, Joshua David Stein. Hi, Joshua.
Hey.
Hey. You a Pauly Shore fan?
I'm big from Encino Man. As
yeah, I met him.
Yeah, life-changing stuff.
Yeah, you know, he was on the show. And now you're on the show.
Following in the footsteps of Pauly Shore.
Just saying, no pressure.
Gotta live.
We have a lot to talk about with Joshua. He is the editor at large of Tasting Table, among many other things that he does, including authoring books and writing brilliant articles. But before we
Pauly Shore never wrote any brilliant articles, did he?
Maybe he did. They just weren't published. but let's start with the antithesis of brilliant. Let's talk about some food news of the week, if you don't mind indulging me. First thing I heard about this week was that China is trying to get into the wine game. I don't know if you're like, all right, maybe. Yeah.
I get it.
Well, do you? I don't. Well, apparently, like, France and Italy and, you know, climate change, like, they're not going to be producing as much wine in the future. So China's trying to get in on the action, and that seems fair. In order to, I don't know, give them an edge, they have decided to shoot grapes into outer space in order to try and see if the grapes will then develop genetic mutations and learn how to survive in unnaturally cold regions of the earth.
Look, I think China knows what's up. They know that this world is ending, and if we want to have wine in space after the earth collapses.
It's not wine in space, it's wine in China. Nice. I feel like that's so, like, it's like the ultimate, like, trial by fire. It's like, if grapes aren't going to grow on Earth, we're going to shoot them into space, and they're going to have to adapt.
Yeah.
Like, they're just going to have to figure it out. That's it. That's the ultimate. Like, it's tough love.
But I do have to say I'm pro China wine.
Good. Yeah. I'm pro, plum wine.
Just in the sense that, it is an emerging market. They have billions of people who might drink it, and, you know, we should relinquish our terroir now that we don't know how to take care of it and we've ruined the globe.
No, no fault of China's whatsoever.
Not at all. Global warming was just like the long game of China to develop their wine
nice.
Industry.
Oh my God. That's so like weird and draconian. Okay. So it's officially fall and you know what that means.
Pumpkin
spice latte. Yeah, pumpkin spice lattes. And in Japan, because that's where they do these kind of things, McDonald's over there has created pumpkin spice flavored french fries.
Okay.
Okay. You're like, that's fine.
Asia.
Once again, we're just like.
Yeah, the third one better be.
Subtle racism over here. It's not that we're racist. We're just like in awe.
Yeah.
Of choices with food. I don't know.
I think that's called raw cyst.
Oh.
Hey, do we have a rim shot, please?
Ba-dum-bum. I don't know. That might be the most egregious pumpkin spice flavored food I have heard of in a while. There's actually a picture, and I'm sorry, listeners at home, you can't see it, but you could Google it. It's like, it's fries drizzled with like orange and brown.
It's like poutine.
It is poutine. It's exactly what it is.
Do you think they're ever going to create pumpkin spice latte pumpkins? Like to bring it full circle?
Like, you know, like shoot pumpkins into space.
Yeah.
To see if they would like genetically mutate.
Yeah.
Maybe. One can dream. Okay. And lastly, but not leastly, someone, I think not in Asia, perhaps somewhere else, has invented a spray aerosol tea that you can shoot directly into your mouth if you are maybe like Joshua David Stein and very busy and doesn't have time.
I'm pretty sure that's probably in Asia.
Well, if it's not, it should be. Because I think that's maybe where it would be a hit.
Yeah.
Yeah, like if you don't have time to brew a cup of tea, you can now shoot tea out of an aerosol. What is this called?
Like spray it or like shoot it like an air gun?
That's your choice, bro. Like, yeah. That's up to you how you want to handle
depends
your aerosol.
Depends what kind of shit you like getting into.
That's right. Like, I'm not gonna judge it. But I am going to judge it because it's actually disgusting. It's instant tea that shoots out of an aerosol can, a la cheese whiz. It's the future.
Oh, is that the consistency?
Maybe. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know yet.
It sounds like you have
to
do some
out.
More research on this.
I might. Stay tuned. Stay tuned, listeners.
After the break, we'll get to the bottom of what this aerosol
tea is. I say that every week. I'm like, we'll be back with more information on that story. Yeah. For sure. Okay, we'll be back. Don't go away. We've got Joshua David Stein. Well, she's her own.
She's her own female. Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's unique store in Lower Manhattan is home to perhaps the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan, plus the rarest natural sharpening stones and exquisitely designed tableware. They also host special events such as knife sharpening demonstrations and parties with New York's most famous chefs and restaurateurs. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the implicit and elegance of Japanese culture to your table, be it in your home or in the finest restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
And you're listening to The Morning After on Heritage Radio. I'm your host, Sarah Kamen, and I'm here in studio with Joshua David Stein.
Hey.
Hey. Joshua David Stein is the editor-at-large of Tasting Table. He is the author of Can I Eat That? And also Food and Beer. He's a movie critic for Eater, and he is an extremely prolific writer for, I don't know, every single publication ever.
I read a lot.
He does, and I'm really happy he took time out of his extremely busy schedule to be here. Hi, Joshua.
Hey.
You have three names.
Yeah, that's true. Although someone tried to tell me the other day that they have three names, and they're like, my name's like Christina, Chris, and, you know, like,
no,
X-Tina. I was like, no, that's...
No, you're like the Sarah Jessica Parker of the food world.
For
so many reasons.
I'll take it.
Not the least, to begin with, your hair.
That's true. It's beautiful.
It is luxurious.
They can't see it.
How many times do you get stopped on the street a day?
I have been getting comments on it recently. It started recently.
And yeah, really, it is a vibrant Maine.
But you know, here's the thing. Is like, I used to be really impatient, and it doesn't look that great. It might look great at some time, but I thought it would be useful spiritually to have to just wait it out in the weird period and just be okay with it being weird.
Yeah.
And eventually it will become something that I'm proud of.
Are you proud? Because you should be.
I'm getting there.
Did you have a Jufro growing up?
I had a shaved head for a long time.
Oh, that's like the opposite.
Yeah. For a while I had a shaved head, and then I just let my bangs grow.
Nice.
And like they'd grow all the way to my chin, and I like peroxided them.
Nice.
And during my at my bar mitzvah, there's this picture of me with like a shaved head, bangs, and I braided them into two braids that kind of look like
that
antennas.
Was like your fancy look.
Yeah.
Like, I'm a man now. I'm ready for braids.
Yeah, yeah. Hey guys, I'm a man now. Rukatan noi.
Oh, well, it's beautiful, and I think you've finally grown into it.
Thank you.
Where are you from, by the way?
I grew up in Philadelphia.
Oh, okay.
Outside of Philly.
Yeah, I've heard of it. Did you always want to be a writer when you were growing up?
I don't know. I don't think I had any professional
besides being blonde. Growing, you wanted to be.
Yeah. I studied ethnomusicology at NYU. Oh. which is a study of music, mm-hmm. a sociological study of music.
Don't insult my audience.
Hey, person.
Person. People. Persons. More than one. Hi, Mom.
But there's no way that I didn't want to go into academia and probably couldn't cut it anyway. And I started writing then.
I have to say you use more big words than anyone I've ever read.
I love big words.
Oh my God, you're so good at using big words. I have to look up so many words when I read your articles. Do you just know these words or you're like, this is the biggest thesaurus
yeah,
ever?
No, I'm just like, I'll be writing a sentence like, I want a big word here. Like, I've had a lot of like little words
yeah,
like the,
six
if, and, but.
Not big enough.
Yeah. No, I love words, mm-hmm. as silly as that sounds.
No,
Read a lot, and I just like the sense in words that there are words for things. Like sometimes you can't think of something unless you have the word for it, mm-hmm. and there are words for these things, like a feeling, right? And there's one word that describes it, or it's a word that like brings to mind a whole nother like tradition, you know, or area of the world. So I like, you know.
You would have been a great Eskimo.
I would have been in, yeah.
Mr. Calling.
Yeah. Fuck. I think we're called Inuit now.
Oh, I'm sorry. you do have like the most jobs.
I have a lot of jobs.
Yeah. I mean, do you want to go through them or we can skip that?
No, we can do it.
Okay. I am curious because it was almost impossible to figure it out from just what, stalking you.
My current jobs?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm the editor at large at Tasting Table.
Congratulations.
I'm the style correspondent for the Daily Beast, menswear mm-hmm. stuff I write about. I'm a creative director at The Foundry, which is a Time Inc.'s native studio. And I'm a frequent contributor to Eater, where I cover movies, mm-hmm. Eater at the Movies. And what else do I do? I'm working on a couple of book projects, but under wraps right now.
Okay. I
have an album.
You have an album.
Songs for Kids I've had.
Wow. And see that, like, you're also a dad.
Oh, yeah.
Which many people would say is a pretty big job in
itself. It's a big job.
Yeah. What's your secret to balancing everything?
Oh. I just lean in. I think my secret is I do a mediocre job at everything.
I don't
but
think
like,
that's true.
I'm okay with it. No, I will say sometimes it's just like you're busy and you have a lot of stuff to do, but there doesn't need to be stress attached to it. You're just doing it and there's a lot of stuff to do. You know what I mean?
I know what you mean, but I think, you know, easier said than done for most people.
Yeah, but once you realize that you're the one bringing the stress, mm-hmm. then you realize you can stop
it. It's like
it.
A very zen approach to it. And I will say from, you know, reading a lot of things that you've written lately, it does feel like your words and the way you write, like, it just flows. Like, it feels very organic, you know, and a lot of people talk about, even though they're writers, how hard it is to write. And even, like, Ruth Reichl talks about, like, how she hates writing.
Yeah.
And I don't get that sense from reading your pieces. Like, they kind of feel effortless.
I don't think they're effortless, but I do really like writing.
That
like,
really comes
if I'm
across.
Feeling, I don't know. Well, you know, getting in the flow, like when you're good at something, it feels nice to do it. And I feel like I'm pretty good at writing.
They do feel like they pour from you, if that makes sense.
I think sometimes it depends. I mean, you're also a writer. And I oftentimes, it's like some pieces don't come and you're just shuffling paragraphs around. I mean, it's a little bit in the nitty gritty, but what I feel like I do is like I know my word count. I have some things I want to say. Now my life is a lot less cluttered that Gawker's not around because I would do this thing where I'd like write a paragraph, maybe check New York Times, check New York Magazine, check The Guardian, check Gawker, you know, like
yeah.
check Twitter. It's like I just had this thing and I've been really trying hard to just sit with not knowing what to say for a little, as opposed to just hitting eject and then like coming back to it, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But once you hit that word count, like once it's 2,000 words and you're at 2,000 words, then all of a sudden I feel like I can write because it's like, okay, mm-hmm. I did it. And now I can actually be, you know, a little more free.
You can consult. 16 thesauruses around here.
Exactly. Like, all these words are great, but they're two syllables or less.
Long enough. Yeah. People might understand these words.
Yeah, gotta get about.
You do write a lot about fashion, which is really interesting. Like, because you are primarily a food writer, do you approach it in a way, like, do you see fashion and food intersecting, or are they very compartmentalized for you?
Well, I've always done menswear and fashion. Mm-hmm. I used to work at Gilt Group.
And you are a fashionista.
And I am a fashionista. Roberto's. I've always done, I've written about fashion a lot for Esquire, for, you know, stuff like that. I think the major thing that I see is that both food and fashion are an outgrowth of the culture. So, like, it doesn't make sense to examine either one in isolation. Mm-hmm. And of course, now food is super trendy and blah, blah, blah. I mean, yeah, I guess in some way, similarities, you can see how trends and tastes are diffused through different kind of cultures. You know, like in food, you see some trends start at the very top, and then it takes like 3 years, and they get to the mid tier, and then 5 years, and then it's like Burger King is doing seasonal or, you know, or like regional stuff, right? Yeah, so that's an example of it going top down. You have the same thing with fashion, where you see something on the runways, it's a trend, and then you see how that trend is diffused and spreads throughout the industry to like prêt-à-porter and then like, you know, fast fashion and all that stuff. So you can, that's an interesting thing. But I think you can see that in anything, like writing, music, architecture. It's just how trends and ideas circulate.
Yeah. One thing that you do as a food writer, which I think separates you from the majority of food writers, and which I personally really admire about you, is that you don't just write about a restaurant or you write about a plate. You expose kind of like the political undercurrent that exists.
Yeah.
And you've done that with a lot of pieces, like the Charlie Bird one, I know, got a lot of attention.
Yeah.
Because you talked about the hip hop in the restaurant as opposed to just like, you know, whatever, the pasta, and that really rubbed you the wrong way. And I know you write about like the movie column for Eater, and like you just talked about that with the Eddie Murphy movie you just saw.
Mr. Church.
Yeah. Yeah. And like it's really poignant, and I mean, especially I feel like it's very current and it's very important. But why do you think that so many food writers don't do that?
I think there's this idea when you're writing about restaurants that you evaluate only what's put in front of you, and you evaluate what they want you to evaluate. Mm-hmm. Like, you go to Charlie Bird, and you're supposed to just see the scene and the food and the wine and not examine the underpinnings. And it's like, I think a lot of people think, well, that's not really the role of a restaurant critic or a food writer to do that. But I think if you respect restaurants and you respect kind of the medium, I guess, it deserves critical thought. Why would you not think critically about that stuff? I mean, for me, I don't know if our readers at home know this about me, but I'm a white male, Joshua David Stein. You know, I think it's becoming more clear to me now, but I feel like I've had this idea that I also need to examine my own relation to the world and my unseen biases and what I take for granted. And I see that now, and I try to see that in the things that I evaluate too. You know, it's not like you can only confine that sort of conversation to some topics. I mean, I write about food. That's what I do. So I try to address those issues through writing about food. You know, like, I'm not going to be a restaurant critic, say, oh, this spaghetti carbonara is unctuous and whatever the fuck. Like, yeah, I'll say that if it's true, but, oh, yeah. So it's not like I would do that and then write another article about white privilege that has nothing to do with food. Like, this is my livelihood, and I want to address the issues that I think are important through, you know, my area of expertise.
Yeah. I mean, I was so struck when I read your review about Guy Fieri's.
Yeah.
Or Ferry.
Fetty.
Fetty, whatever he calls himself.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't realize he'd actually changed his name until I read your article. His name was like Guy Fieri originally.
It was Guy Fieri, yeah.
And now it's Fieri. That's funny. But I was so struck by it because obviously like the Pete Wells review got so much attention. And
yeah.
It was really like a turning point for Pete Wells' career because he made fun of the restaurant and he used it as an opportunity to be like as snarky as he could. And you used it as an opportunity to really like eviscerate Guy Fieri and call him for what he is, which, I mean, to use your word, a villain, like someone who is aware of the obesity crisis in America.
Yeah.
And still, you know, panders to the type of diner who gets nostalgic over like this, you know, American themed restaurant and like feels compelled to shove down like fried food smothered in like whatever sauce because they feel like, I don't know, some sort of like patriotic.
Yeah, it's pretty serious. I mean, to a fault sometimes, I take these things really seriously. Like I am.
Don't think it's to a fault. I think it's really important. And I was so overcome with like the fact that you were doing your job, you know, and like other people aren't willing to kind of stand up to the industry.
Yeah. Yeah. But the Guy Fieri thing in particular, I was really upset. Like I do get genuinely upset, especially like something like that, where there are people who are harmed by it. Same thing with the same thing with the Charlie Bird piece and Red Rooster. And I think those are some of the pieces I wrote about the Red Rooster when I reviewed the Cecil. And I think food writing is fine, right? Like you can tell nice stories if you're reviewing restaurants, or Pete's piece, which I think was like enjoyable. It was definitely like funny, but I want to do something a little more, maybe serious or more impactful. So if I can use the language of a restaurant review or use food writing language to address the actual issues, which I think are important about, you know, race and in Charlie Bird's case, you know, like appropriation and gender inequality or gun control with Guy Fieri and obesity. Like, yeah, you might think, oh yeah, it's a food review. Why are you talking about those things? But it's like, you're reading them. I mean, like, it gets you in the food writing gets you in the door to talk about these other issues. And also, not to say that I don't love writing about food, just writing about food. But even when I love a place, I think I'm still trying to get at something a little bit deeper, whether it is like a respect for the ingredient or relationships with farmers or, you know, whatever, or just a pure artistic vision. Like, that's equally exciting.
I think it's so important because, you know, food politics feels... It's like it's almost like you can't talk about it in the food writing space. It's like it's reserved for like policy people, like when we talk about nutrition and like the Marianne Nestles of the world. But so few people use actual restaurant culture as like a platform to speak up about this. And I just appreciate that you're definitely one of the only voices out there taking the opportunity to use food, you know, as an actual lens for the other issues. I know I'm like gushing a little bit, but.
Well, I think, you know, I really appreciate it. I appreciate hearing it.
It's very uncommon.
The thing is, to your point, though, it's like, if you're not interested in food politics, fewer people are interested in food politics than they are in restaurant reviews, right? People just want to go out, know what's good and know what's bad, and maybe read a good slam or whatever. So if you can use that medium to get inside and gain access and get people to pick it up... like, that's a wonderful covert operation to then talk about what's really meaningful. And it's not that it's at odds with a restaurant review. That's part of the restaurant. Like, I think, for me, the difference is thinking about whether a restaurant has good or bad food, good or bad service, whatever, and thinking about whether a restaurant is fundamentally good or bad. Like, is it a good moral manifestation in this world, or does it have a net negative effect? And what are some of the issues at work here? That's part of what a restaurant is. It's not just about the food. It's not just about the service. It's about
it's an environment.
It's a whole environment.
Yeah. And you know, on that note, you resigned from The Observer, where you were the food critic, which is like a pretty cushy, sweet job.
It was awesome.
Yeah, you got paid to eat food, and they endorsed Trump as a paper, and you stepped down. But you did it in a very, very public way. You didn't just step down. You wrote an article explaining why you stepped down and published it in The Guardian.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how did that go, first of all? Like, when you left, what was that like? And then why did you choose to do it so publicly instead of just, you know, stepping down and moving on?
How did it go? You know, to be honest, it was... I'm very appreciative of Ken Carson, my editor there. I had kind of run my... I felt like I was running my course there anyway. The paper itself had been changing, and I was growing increasingly uncomfortable with how close they were with Trump even before they endorsed him. You know, it's owned by his son-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
And you could... And I just could see it getting worse and worse. And when they actually did endorse him, it just forced my hand a little because it was so egregious and something I disagree with so strongly, that when I was weighing on one hand the wonderful opportunity I had as a critic to write the pieces that I thought were important. And
I mean, not to mention you're supporting a family. It's not an easy decision to quit your job, I'm sure.
Yeah. I mean, I did have other, revenue streams. But yeah, that sucked. But I just couldn't justify it with what I was... like, you can't say, oh, I get to write good things. I get to eat well. I get paid. Okay, that's cool. You're also working for a paper which is supporting a racist demagogue and engaged in a whole bunch of other sort of terrifyingly unethical journalistic practices. It just didn't square up. Mm-hmm. And as to why I did it publicly, you know, I hope that I had the chance to show people that you can be engaged in your own moral universe and sometimes that and each one of us bears responsibility for the implications of our actions. So if I was supporting Donald Trump in whatever way, that's on me.
Yeah.
You know, I have that responsibility. So that's why.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You have two books out. True. Can I Eat That?
Yeah.
Which is inspired by your son, or your son's plural.
Mostly Achilles, my older son. He doesn't eat anything. Augie eats everything.
Okay, cool. It's like a guide to what's edible, what's not. I think it's totally, it can apply to adults as well.
Yeah, I think I've been gratified to see how many people have responded to it. I think for me, like, I would just fight with it. I mean, I still fight with him all the time, but there's never a way to talk about food which wasn't... And we didn't have any books that talked about food that weren't, like Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, which I love.
It's a great book.
But it's fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not food is food. Or, like, Runaway Dinner, which is another good food book, but the food's personified. Or something like... eat your veggies, like do this thing, right? I wanted to just talk about food without saying you have to eat it, and also without not treating it like food.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we did.
Has it been helpful?
Nope.
You're really selling it.
Has it been helpful? I mean,
for you personally,
he's really proud of the book.
Aww.
My daddy wrote that. I did a reading, and he demanded to sit next to me on a chair, and he stood up. He's like, "My daddy wrote this."
Hell yeah, he did.
That was the best feeling that any father could have.
That's really sweet.
Yeah.
And then tell us about Food and Beer.
So Food and Beer is a
cookbook. It's not for kids.
Not for kids.
Maybe in Europe.
Yeah, there is actually kids. There's something in Denmark called Kids Beer. But yeah, this is a book I did with Jeppe Jarnett Bergsøe, the brewer from Evil Twin, and
that's a big word.
Yeah, Jeppe, well, it's Jeppe. Three. Let's just call him Jeppe. He runs Evil Twin, and he and Daniel Burns run Luxus and Torst in Greenpoint. And Luxus is the only Michelin-starred restaurant with a beer-only pairing. Daniel's a chef, former head of R&D at Momofuku, and pastry chef at Noma. So the book is really trying to make the case that that beer should be considered on par with wine in terms of pairing. And it's just crazy that it's not.
Mm-hmm.
So there's recipes, there's essays. It's a ton of fun to work on. And
why do you think it's not?
I think it has to do with the fact that wine necessitates a lot of capital. You know, you need land, you need fruit, you need the process to do it. Beer, anyone can do.
Mm-hmm.
It's not regional. you know, you have your ingredients they keep. You know, you have your malt, hops, yeast, and water. So you can assemble that anywhere. You can do it at home.
Yeah.
So it's really like a ground-up thing, not a top-down thing. And I think that's whereas fine dining is very much a top-down thing. It's just like a top thing, really. So to change the mentality that just because it's like a democratic form, that doesn't mean it's not precious and not worthy of esteem.
Yeah. Take note, China.
Take note, China.
Yeah. So we're going to have to take a break in a minute, but you have so many jobs.
Yeah.
You've had so many jobs. Are there any jobs out there that you don't have but you want to have? Like, what would your dream job be one day? And it doesn't have to be food or writing.
I guess I would like to write books.
You know, do that.
I want to write books. I'd like to be an author and have the chance to, you know, pursue longer, more involved projects than what I can do right now with all my other stuff going on. But I think more generally, it's cheesy to say and like very sincere, but I just want a chance to be creative. Mm-hmm. I just want to, you know, pursue however that's manifest.
Yeah. Do you think about what you would do if you weren't a writer or if you couldn't write one day?
No, it's never occurred to me, honestly.
I mean, what about that thing? Like, you know, we all have that job growing up where we're like, I want to be a fireman or like, I want to be an astronaut. Like, did you ever have something kind of outlandish that you're like, yeah, that would still be pretty cool?
Oh, huh.
Well, I don't want to put you on.
No.
Great.
Really? No. I mean, as long, you know, you asked if I had always wanted to be a writer. No, I don't think I did. But ever since I can remember, which is like, you know, I'm 35, since I was 17 and I went to college, you know, I've always been writing. So I feel like that's a long time. And I've been really, and I'm really fortunate to be so happy, you know, doing this thing.
Yeah. Well, I'm really glad you do it because it sure is fun to read your writing.
I'm glad you're glad.
Oh, my God. Okay. We're going to take a break and cry and like talk about our feelings. We'll be right back with Joshua David Stein and the Morning After Quiz. And we're back. You're listening to The Morning After on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Sari Kamen. I've been here talking with the very sincere and smart Joshua David Stein. He's a food writer. But now all that sappy stuff has come to an end because it is time.
Oh, man.
It's time for The Morning After Quiz.
Lay it on me.
All right. So the deal is there's going to be three questions. They are multiple choice. Each have three possible answers, and that's about it. It's going to be about something you may or may not know.
Okay.
So, Joshua, your name is Joshua David Stein.
True.
Yes. That's not the quiz. No, that's not the quiz. So you know all about Stein being your last name, but I don't know what you know about Steinway and Sons or Steinway Pianos. So
a lot.
Oh, great. Let's find out. Okay, first question.
88.
Okay, where and when did Steinway and Sons begin? Was it A, 1820 in Siezen, Germany, in the home of Heinrich Engelhard Steinweg? B, 1825 in Russia, under the ordinance of the new Tsar, Alexander I? Or 1853 by German immigrant Henry Engelhard Steinway in a Manhattan loft on Varick Street?
Varick.
Varick is the right answer. Yes. Congratulations. I will say, had you guessed A, you wouldn't have been entirely wrong, because Heinrich Engelhard Steinway did first make pianos in the 1820s from his house in Germany, and then he moved his entire family to America in 1850, his wife and his 8 children, and he changed his name to Steinway.
I'd rather be entirely correct than not entirely wrong.
Great. You're doing really well so far then. Okay, so what was founder, the second question, what was the founder Henry E. Steinway's guiding
principle? Oh shit, they're all about Steinway?
They're all about Steinway.
Okay. Okay, go on.
But there's only 2 more questions.
Okay, go.
Okay, so what was his guiding principle? Was it A, build the best piano possible, make no compromise in quality? Was it B, build a piano that is stronger than Zeus, but more elegant than Andromeda? Or C, if it is not a Steinway, then it does not equal perfection?
Gonna go with...
They can be repeated if needed.
No. Andromeda and Zeus is interesting, and it does make sense. But I'm still gonna go with C.
Not a Steinway does not equal perfection. No, it was A.
God damn it to fucking hell.
Not overreacting. Build the best piano possible.
Stupid, Josh, stupid.
And you have to think of it, you have to think of it in a German accent, so it's... Yeah. You know, make no compromise.
Oh, yeah, right. I didn't think if that was my thing, is I didn't think about it in an accent.
Yes, that's the clincher.
Because C is, if it is not a Steinway.
If it is not a Steinway.
It is nicked a piano.
Yeah, exactly.
Das ist nicked piano.
Isn't it weird that he went from Steinweg to Steinway?
Yeah.
It's like Stein 9 to Stein Ja. Okay, I'm so good at German.
What was Do you speak German? That's really good.
9. What was the Steinway factory in Queens ordered to build during World War II instead of regular pianos? Was it A, false teeth for the wounded Allied soldiers made from the ivory that was normally used to make piano keys? Was it B, looms to make soldiers' uniforms using the strings from the piano? The factory was temporarily turned into a facility that produced uniforms for the American troops. Or C, small pianos called Victory Verticals that 4 men could lift, painted olive gray or blue, designed to be carried aboard ships or dropped by parachute from an airplane to bring music to the soldiers.
Before I answer this, can I just ask something about the quiz?
Yeah.
So you thought of all the ones that are not correct?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Thanks.
You put so much effort into it.
Just a little bit.
Okay, so A is teeth from the ivory, B is uniforms, and C is our victory uprights painted in olive or khaki?
Yeah.
And dropped from the sky.
Yeah.
Well, only because it's so fucked up if you thought of C, I'm still going to choose C.
Yeah, C is right.
Okay, great. Yeah.
But I was pretty proud of the teeth.
The whole thing is great.
And then, like, making looms with
the
strings.
Looms.
I know. That's, like, if you really think about it.
That's a reach.
It's a reach.
The teeth was... But then I thought, they probably don't manufacture the ivory keys there.
No.
So then I went with C. But that's really great stuff there.
Thanks. Yeah. Well, you got 2 right. That's really good. Yay. All right. That's our show. Thank you, Joshua, so much for coming on. It was... an honor. You are a mensch.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Thanks for listening to The Morning After. We'll be back next week, Sunday at 3 o'clock.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.